Welcome to the Tao of Color Grading interview series, where we talk with influencers, thought leaders, and professionals about the field of color grading for moving images. Show notes, links, our free weekly newsletter, and our color training products can be found at taoofcolorgrading.com. And I'm your host, Patrick Inhofer. This is part two of our three-part interview with Alexis Van Herkman. Today, we chat about his Apple Pro Training Series books. We'll talk about his latest book, The Color Correction Handbook. We also chat about colorist control surfaces, the power of vignettes, how we see color, and a whole lot more. It is a jam-packed 49 minutes. Let's go.
After writing all the technical manuals, you wrote two Apple Pro Training Series books. Encyclopedia of Color Correction and...
Was it Advanced Color Correction and Effects in Final Cut Pro 5 came first?
That came first?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, what were the two different approaches between the two books?
Well, Color Correction and Effects, and I have to give props to Michael Wall for getting me that gig. And by the way, Michael Wall's books are great too. You should check them out. He did the color... Authorized Color Training Series,
right,
which I tech edited the last version, and it's a nice book. But with the color correction and effects in Final Cut Pro 5, I'd actually inherited a previous edition, and it needed to be updated. And you know, being me, I couldn't help but do maybe a little more revision than they wanted me to based on the schedule. But the thing about color correction examples, especially writing color correction examples, if you swap the media, you've just rewritten the example. There's no way you can change media and shoehorn it into what was previously written, because every shot has its own qualities in so many different ways. So that right there meant that, you know, I did a huge rewrite of the color correction section specifically. But, you know, the mandate there was it's a training title. It's meant to fit into a curriculum. Okay. It was meant to be the follow-up, the follow-up in a series of books. And so there were explicit goals there that weren't necessarily my own. They were bad. They were just, you know, that book was meant to be a certain thing, and I wrote to the requirement.
Is that true also of the encyclopedia?
The encyclopedia was actually my pitch.
Okay.
After I did the first one, I went back and I said, you know, I'd really like to do a general purpose book on color correction overall. You know, I wanted to do an intermediate book, because the Color Correction 5 book got you started. It gave you all the basics. But it didn't get into an enormous amount of why and wherefore. It didn't get into a lot of advanced techniques. It didn't get into a lot of things that I was doing all the time. And I'm like, this would be interesting to people. I think there's people at that point were just starting to get an awareness that color correction was something that they could do, even in the Final Cut Pro timeline. And that Final Cut Pro's tools are surprisingly advanced if you abuse the tool set beyond what was originally designed, which any of us who've done any amount of grading in Final Cut Pro can attest. You can do neat things. It just takes a few hoops you got to jump through.
It can be a little painful.
So, yeah. So the Encyclopedia of Color Correction was the hoops book.
Right.
And that was, you know, it was a great book to write. People who have gotten back to me after buying it and reading it have had amazingly wonderful things to say. It was very gratifying to me. But the one thing it lacks, I should say there are two things that particular book lacks. One, it's focused on NLE grading. And, you know, it's the concepts are applicable to the Avid as well, yeah, even though it's very Final Cut Pro specific in terms of the buttons you push and the switches you flick and the options that you use. But, you know, I mean, grading at a certain point, grading is grading. You know, color balance controls are color balance controls.
And one of the things that, you know, in your book, it's called the encyclopedia because it kind of, it starts at A and goes to Z.
Well, and it's an encyclopedia, exactly. That was the second.
But before you get there, the thing that you do there is if you take day for night and you want to do a day for night and a client comes to you, I shot this day for night.
Right.
And you've never done day for night. You can open up the book and the first thing it tells you is what does it mean when they're talking day for night?
Mm-hmm.
So that you understand what the basic concept is, which can be applied anywhere. And then here are the specific steps you go through, in this case, Final Cut, to make that happen.
Right.
But to modify those steps for Color or Avid, Symphony or Media Composer, whatever, isn't a huge leap.
It's not a huge leap. Mm-hmm. It's not a huge leap. But looking at the audience of people who are new to this field, you know, if you're going to be more general, it helps to be more general.
Yeah.
And that was the impetus.
Well, I think the sad thing about the Encyclopedia of Color Correction is that Apple Color came out shortly on the heels, and then you're looking at the encyclopedia saying, okay,
but
where's the color version?
Pro. Yeah. Yeah, I know. It was.
And I was a little bummed that they didn't have you come out and do a color version.
It was disappointing timing.
Yeah.
But, you know, whatever. Water under the bridge.
Exactly.
So, anyway, it's a very good book, and it's still in stores. And if you're a Final Cut Pro grader, get it, because it's got a lot of specific information for you. However, the follow-up book, which just came out, I just finished it.
Hand-delivered to me today, faster than Amazon.
Faster than Amazon.
Thank you very much.
That's me.
Yep.
is the Color Correction Handbook. And that is my baby because unlike the encyclopedia, the Color Correction Handbook it's organized in terms of the way I would approach teaching you soup to nuts about the discipline and the art of color correction. So it's organized more like a curriculum, but it's got the depth of information that I put into the encyclopedia.
Right.
So, and in fact, it goes far deeper and much broader than the encyclopedia did, just because it's not trying to be a step-by-step walkthrough for a specific platform.
Right. So you've got the same thickness of book. I'm looking at the two right here. You got the same. It's even a little thicker, but
it's a little bigger.
It doesn't have those step-by-steps. So you've got to have to fill that out with just content.
It's packed with content. I mean, it does have some step-by-steps in there, but it's much more abstracted because, again, I am also seeking for this to be a platform agnostic work.
Right.
I talk specifically about DaVinci Resolve. I talk specifically about Assimilate Scratch. I talk specifically about Baselight. I talk specifically about, Pablo's got some information in there. I really wanted to focus on grading tools that were compatible with a control surface,
right,
on the premise that if you're a professional colorist, and you know, it's not the requirement it once was, right? 5 years ago, a grading tool compatible with a control surface was at least $150,000-$200,000.
Right.
You know, nowadays you can pick up a Wave for $1,400. You can pick up a copy of DaVinci Resolve for another $1,000 and you're going.
You know?
Or you can pick up a Wave or a Euphonics or a JL Cooper to use with Color,
right,
which you probably already have if you've got Final Cut Pro. It's not the burdensome requirement it once was. But the truth is, if you're serious about doing color correction in a comfortable and quick manner, then having a control surface is an enormous help. And, you know, and having a dedicated app, I mean, Colorista is a fantastic plugin. You know, I've always been a fan of the built-in plugins in Final Cut Pro, and there's a ton of other filters and plugins on the market that you can soup up either Final Cut Pro or Avid or Premiere with, you know, or After Effects if you're inclined to use After Effects for your grading, if you're an especially hardy soul. And they're great, and they're high quality, and they do what you want them to do. But the overall UI is not set up to work quickly. And it's the kind of thing where when, you know, if you're a Final Cut Pro user out there or an Avid user out there, you're sitting there going, what the hell is he talking about? You know, I don't need a dedicated UI. I'm doing just fine. Once you start using a dedicated UI, there's no going back. You're like, oh my God, I can't believe all the hoops I jumped through to do that thing or this thing. I mean, that, you know, DaVinci Resolve was designed for grading. That's all it is designed to do. Color is designed for grading. Base light is designed for grading. You can't, you know, you don't edit in those apps. You don't do, you know, compositing beyond a certain point in those apps. They are entirely pragmatically designed to make the process of balancing shots, stylizing shots, and organizing saved grades for those shots so that you can use them later on in the program as intuitive and as quick as possible. And by intuitive, I don't mean necessarily intuitive to come to as a raw recruit.
Right.
I mean, once you learn how to use the tool, it makes sense. You know, those were the apps and methodologies that I wanted to focus on, because in truth, there are very few books that have approached that level of app, because in truth, there aren't, you know, up till now, there are not thousands and thousands of base lights in the world. There are not thousands and thousands of Assimilate Scratch owners.
Well, I was going to ask, do you have a base light and a scratch in your...
No,
I
don't.
Okay.
Now, I should say Assimilate was kind enough to loan me a license of Scratch. So while I was developing the book, I actually did have a copy of Scratch. I had to set up a bootcamp partition on my Mac to get it going. But I had it to develop some of the exercises with. So everything that appears in the book, you know, I was sitting in front of the app working with it. DaVinci was kind enough to let me into their beta program. So I have and continue to have licenses of DaVinci that I've started using professionally at this point. But, you know, Iridis gave me a license of SpeedGrade to bang on. You know, I was developing the exercises using these high-end apps. Obviously, I had Color as well.
Right.
But, you know, and it was great also to get a comparison between all of the different apps. You know, one question I've always had is, you know, how do the major grading apps compare in terms of features? You know, do some grading apps have things that other grading apps don't have? Who has what feature set? They're toolboxes. All the grading apps are toolboxes. They just have slightly different variations in the same tools. You know, they all have hammers. They all have pliers. Some of them have a needle nose pliers. Other ones don't.
Right.
You know, that was another interesting thing that I wanted to do for the book, is to give people a sense of which apps had which tools.
So after I finish reading this book, I should be able to walk away with a good sense of why do people pay for Baselight as opposed to...
You'll have a sense. You'll have a sense. I mean, I focus in the book on the shared tool set, obviously,
right.
Because the goal of the book is not just to be a survey, but to actually teach you how to do stuff.
Right.
So
the common elements between Scratch, Baselight.
The common elements are covered most extensively. And then what I do is where one app has a significant feature that others do not, I'll call that out in a sidebar or add a few pages. I'll add a section about that.
So let me ask you, because, you know, when Apple Color was Final Touch, if you got a 2K license that allowed you to work at 2K in Final Touch, that cost you $20,000.
Right.
Apple buys it, rebrands it, stuffs it in with Final Cut, and doesn't charge a dime extra, and they give you the 2K. So all these guys, all these companies that had Final Touch suddenly jump ship because it's a common tool. Right. Part of what they are selling is a exclusivity.
Exclusivity.
Right. Now we've got DaVinci, which, I mean, Avatar, right? So if it's good enough for James Cameron, in theory, it should be good enough for this thing I'm putting up on YouTube.
In theory.
So my question to you is it fair to say that Apple Color is any less of a grading tool than DaVinci is any less of a grading tool than, let's say, Baselit?
It is. I'm trying to come up with a politic answer.
We can have opinions.
No, we can have opinions. We can have opinions, but
I should
make it clear that every single one of these apps has pluses and minuses.
Right.
And they, those pluses and minuses, I personally find are often more in the workflows behind them than in the actual tool set. You know, when you're talking about three-way, when you're talking about primary color correction, three-way grading, curves, contrast adjustment, they all have it. Every single one of them. I can do primary grades on all of them. When you come to secondary grades, most of them have the basics, HSL qualification and shapes. Some apps have a few additional options. For example, Baselit has some additional vector controls, has some other interesting HSL qualified modification modes that you can use. Assimilate Scratch has a vector interface that a lot of people seem to like. Final Cut Pro has a hue curves interface that Baselit, or not Baselit, because Baselit does have it, DaVinci Resolve lacks. On the other hand, DaVinci Resolve has some aspects to their HSL keying that I find in some respects is cleaner than what Color is doing. So, you know, it's pluses and minuses among all of the apps. And the bottom line is I can get the same job done in any of them with very few examples. You know, I'll give you an example of something that is, you know, that is unique. And that's if you look at, like, FilmMaster has layer-based compositing built into it that is a little After Effects-like, and they've got more transfer modes. You look at Assimilate Scratch, they have incorporated transfer modes in a certain amount of layer-based compositing. You look at Color, and it has some of that in the color effects by default, but not all of it. You look at DaVinci Resolve, and they don't have transfer modes, and they don't have layering in that way. So that's a specific example of something where if you need that, if you absolutely require layering with transfer modes, then that will dictate some of your choices. But, you know, the average grade that I do doesn't, you know, layering is not a requirement. And, you know, the Robin Hood movie that came out.
Yes,
with Russell Crowe.
Thank you. Yep.
That was done in Resolve.
Right.
And, you know, by Company 3, which is one of the biggest companies in our business with some of the most talented colorists. I'm not going to go into Company 3 and say, you guys are chuckleheads because you're not using transfer modes and you obviously don't know what you're doing. No, they're doing amazing grading, and huge clients are coming to them with extremely expensive, prestigious projects. So you understand my reluctance to, you know, to endorse a specific product based on the tool set. Stepping back from that to what I was talking about earlier, workflow.
Right.
Workflow is important. A lot of people are passionate about Assimilate Scratch because they love the conforming workflow.
Yeah.
You know, people who are coming out of Final Cut Pro, even after they've been exposed to DaVinci Resolve, still see the advantage of the XML round trip workflow that Color offers.
Right.
People who are doing all red projects look at DaVinci Resolve, and it's the greatest thing since sliced bread, because they have an incredibly straightforward, easy to implement R3D conforming workflow. So, you know, it's really which product is best for you depends on the type of clients you have. It depends on the types of projects you work on. It depends on the kind of workflows you need to accommodate.
And I think that when I think about, you know, why is one product, I'll use Baselight because it's a very popular high-end grading tool. You know, one of the things you're buying is the ability to integrate into huge render farms with multiple GPU cards, with, you know, they've got all of this back-end stuff that is largely hidden from the color. I mean, the colors are just there doing his job.
Right.
And you can turn around a 4K grade, spit it out at the speed that is required for a feature film that has to release the weekend of Thanksgiving.
Exactly.
You know, whereas if you don't have those deadlines and you have more time than you have money, then you can kind of scale down to some of these other packages.
That's precisely right. I mean, you know, Quantel is another example of that. Their Pablo system is incredibly powerful. It is not cheap. I think you're looking at $300,000 to $500,000, depending on how you get the thing configured.
Yeah.
But what one thing it does is if you're in a shop and you're required to do multiple simultaneous deliverables, it scales, and it scales in real time. And you can sit there and spit out different deliverables all day long. SD, HD, SD letterbox, you know, HD anamorphic, 2K, 4K, whatever you want to do. You just flip some switches and it spits them out. And if you're working in a broadcast shop and you need to do that all the time, that pays for itself.
Right.
You know.
Right. The costs of missing the deadline are so enormous.
Yeah.
You can't risk it.
Yeah. The cost of missing the deadline is, you know, what? BBC Four has no programming that night.
Yeah, which means
you're not an option.
You don't have a job Monday morning. You're done. You're toast.
Exactly.
Yeah, you're the guy.
So what platform is best for you goes back to what you're doing. And that's why I don't get into advocating platforms in the book.
Right.
The book is all about technique. The book is all about, you know, giving you a framework for understanding how to evaluate an image, how to spot things that would benefit from adjustment, and how to implement those adjustments in the widest variety of ways on any platform.
So if I'm a Final Cut editor,
yes,
and I'm deciding that this whole color grading thing is kind of interesting because I've been reading all about this DaVinci Resolve stuff, and I read your book, and I'm not going to become a full-time colorist. I love editing.
Mm-hmm.
Is there value in that for me?
Yeah, absolutely.
And how would you explain what that value is?
The value for the NLE editor is exposing you to the menu of techniques that people use day in and day out. You know, one of my experiences, and I'm sure you've had the same experience, and a lot of us who, we didn't come out of a big shop.
Right.
You know, we bootstrapped ourselves into the field from different avenues. You know, I was an editor and also a compositing artist. And that kind of compositing background morphed into color correction via some great opportunities I happened to have.
Right.
But when you come up on your own, you know, you develop a lot of techniques that you use. But you always wonder, is this what people really do?
Yeah.
Or am I just crazy? You know, yeah. Or am I doing this in the slowest possible way? Or, you know, you wonder.
Yeah.
You're sort of plagued with doubts. How is crushing the blacks good? Well, clients seem to like it, but am I somehow damaging the image? Is there a limit to how far I should go? Same thing with clipping the whites and legalization, and you know, there's a lot of stuff that you can figure out on your own, but you're unsure of the technique, or you don't know what the boundaries are. You've got a Beretta and you know you can blow holes in things, but you don't know how precisely you can do so. And you know, that's one of the, I think, the benefits to my book is it runs through many, if not most, of the basic things that we all do. And I also try to get into a lot of creative techniques as well. I try to go through, this is the origin of the technique, you know, this is vignetting is a great example, is nothing new. We've had vignetting since the silent movie days when people were literally putting cut pieces of cardboard in front of the lens. It is absolutely not a new technique. You look at the old masters, they're doing natural vignetting. Photographers have been using vignetting for years.
I like to say that as far as colorists go, there's a lot to be learned from photography and Photoshop guys. You know, that they've, in many ways, have been exploring this territory 10 years longer than we have.
Yeah. In many ways, yeah. Yeah, but I try to go back farther than that.
Right.
You know, I'm looking at pre-digital, what are things that we're doing right now that actually have been around for longer. And I get into that a little bit. You know, at least it's enough to give a sense of, look, you know, this has traditionally been used for a variety of things long before we got these digital tools. And then digging into, but since we have the digital tools, here are the options we now have that we've never had before.
So then on the concept of vignetting, in my interview with Steve Hullfish, he said, yeah, he goes, you know, a lot of the colorists I talk to, it's kind of a dirty little feeling that they have when they admit that they do a lot of vignetting, because you don't necessarily, it just, you know, it's like a little trick, a little tool you use, but you almost feel a little dirty about it. And you don't really want to advertise that you're doing it, but it's something that...
I think that goes back to a certain feeling of insecurity.
Right.
You know, you don't know if what you're doing is the right way to do it because you've never talked to anyone else about it. And, you know, you don't want to give away your secrets, but then you're wondering if you have the right secrets.
Right.
And, you know, from the first moments, from the first few works I did on color correction, you know, I have always had the sense that, and I'm sure Steve Hullfish probably felt the same way, you're going out on a limb.
Yeah.
You're saying, okay, this is, I've examined this technique that I use. I've looked at how I use vignetting. I've spent some time trying to figure out if there is a faster way of doing the same thing. I've spent a little bit of time examining the image quality ramifications of different ways of doing it. And now I am proposing a framework of how to go about considering, is vignetting a good solution for this? Or is there another solution that might be better? I'm not interested in saying necessarily this is how you do vignetting. I'm interested in this is how you go about thinking and evaluating whether or not vignetting is the right tool for this particular job. And if it is, here are three or four different ways you can use it. Because that's the other thing is, you know, I think everyone knows, yeah, you can slap a vignette on something and you can darken the edges.
Right.
But if we get rid of that word vignetting and substitute it with the word shape,
yep,
or power window, you know, you can adjust focus, you can adjust depth, you can adjust blur, you can adjust color, you can adjust saturation, you can adjust all kinds of things with shapes in various ways.
That don't just result in a darkened, feathered edge.
Right, exactly. Right. Exactly. So that was part of what I wanted to do. And I mean, the reason I write these books is so I can take 7 months off from working as furiously and as quickly as possible with clients and just step back, look at the techniques that I've been using and developing and the things I've heard on the grapevine, and just kind of think about them and say, am I really doing this in the best way or am I not? Or is there a better way of doing this? You know, can I shave down a step? Or why am I doing this thing that I'm doing? I mean, you know, one of the things that always plagued me when I first started grading was, why am I expanding contrast? I mean, obviously it looks better and clients seem to like it and lots of people write, well, you should expand the contrast, so you do. But I'm not happy with rules of thumb. I want to know why I'm doing the thing. Why does increased contrast look good? Why do we perceive it as a beneficial thing? And, you know, I, for this book, went all the way back to a certain amount of vision science. And there's been an enormous amount of research into why expanded contrast works well, why it gives us a pleasing increase in the perception of definition and detail.
Right.
And, you know, and furthermore, getting into, since we're talking about contrast, why is it that you can get an expanded impression of increased contrast even if you're not opening the picture up from 0 to 100? You know, why is it that relative contrast is such a powerful tool and how does that work? And, you know, another thing, I mean, this is something I just really got into in this book, is why do complementary colors neutralize one another? Why?
Right.
We all know it does.
Right.
I mean, it's, you know, every color correction book I've seen talks about, yeah, you add a complementary to a color and it's neutralized.
If you want to get rid of red, go the other direction.
But why? Yeah. Why does that work?
Yeah.
And it turns out that it's a function of the color opponent model of vision that is how our retinas work. I think it doesn't even happen in the brain. It happens in the eyeball.
Right.
Which is fascinating. And for me, comforting. Because at that point, I know why I'm doing it. I know how it works. And it gives me a certain amount of control over the process.
It's even like, you know, RGB, right? Mm-hmm. Why RGB? Why those three colors? And it turns out, you know, like you, when I first started questioning these things, the answer is like, well, that's how we structurally work. And that's kind of a really cool thing. It's like, all right, there's a method and there's a means to all of this. And the more you understand it, the more you can kind of use it mm-hmm. professionally.
Well, the fascinating thing about RGB too is there's a large video engineering component.
Yep.
Into why the tools work the way that they work. And that's, you know, on the one hand, there's the vision research component of it, which is, okay, this is how we see, which is why even though you've perfectly matched the face in shot one with the face in shot two, they don't look like they match.
Yeah.
Because in shot one, your actor is standing in front of a big red wall, and in shot two, the actor is standing in front of a big blue wall.
Yeah.
And perceptually, there's a number of reasons, going back to how our eyes break down the image, why we will never ever see a numeric match
yep.
as being a perceptual match. And when you learn that, it's like, oh, okay, so that's why I'm making this bizarro adjustment that has nothing to do with matching the faces, but has everything to do with matching the overall impression of the frame.
And this is, I think, where people run into problems with relying solely on like the eyedropper, where you eyedrop the whites, you eyedrop the blacks.
Precisely.
You call it a day, and it's like, well, but the two shots don't match, even though the whites and the blacks are technically correct.
I sound like a bit of a broken record in the book, but I hammer on simultaneous contrast a lot. Simultaneous color contrast, simultaneous luma channel contrast. It's a huge deal. It's one reason why, you know, okay, yes, the scopes show things as being a perfect match, but assuming your monitor is perfectly calibrated, the scopes are still secondary to your eyeball. you're mm-hmm. looking at two shots and they just don't look right, and your client's going to keep you honest.
Yeah.
Because it's easy to get lost in your scopes and say, well, you know, the vector scopes line up perfectly and the waveforms match up perfectly. These shots should match. And then your client's like, yeah, but the first one seems too blue. They're not lying to you and they're not being difficult. They're seeing, or rather I should say they are perceiving, the simultaneous contrast interfering with the numerical perfection
right.
of your adjustment.
Right.
And if you don't get with that, you're not going to get to the next level of, you know, perceptual
And we've
matching.
Talked about this before, where one of the techniques I use to kind of get away from the trees and look at the forest is to just kind of quickly scan through the timeline. Just take it and take the jog wheel and zip it real fast and just quickly get an overall balance of the scene. And then see if anything kind of pops out at me as being, whoa, that's kind of wrong in context of this thing flying by me.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that I like to do is, and this is something I've heard from other colorists as well, when you're balancing a scene, don't obsessively think you're going to get it all right in the first go.
Yeah.
You know, balance it and then walk away.
Yeah.
And then take another look at it at the end of the day or the next morning or whenever, because that's when you're going to see that one shot that sticks out a little bit. Editors, I'm fond of saying this, editors don't edit a scene in one go and they're done and it's perfect.
Yep.
So don't think that we colorists are somehow, you know, better endowed.
Well, and it's like
if
you're an editor getting into color grading and you walk in the next morning and it just doesn't look right,
it's worth doing couple of passes.
Yeah, it's okay.
You want to do a couple of passes.
On the Tao color grading training, I balanced in the Final Cut version, I balanced the scene. Then a couple days later, I went to do, all right, now we're going to go do the look, and I look at the scene and it's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, I did another recording, or like, I was wrong. So let's now fix what I originally did. You know, I mean, this is the way my day works.
Right.
You know, and I'll go back. And luckily, hopefully, everything's kind of a little more tightened up, and, you know, you're not off in some real big extreme.
It's an iterative process.
It is.
You know, even if you're getting through a project in one day, I'm going to give you an example. When I do 30-second spots, you know, that is not a multi-day process.
Right.
You know, that's a 2 hour, maybe three, for a 30-second spot, if it has any ambition.
Right.
And I don't, as much as I believe it's an iterative process, it's not like I'm going to have, you know, I'm not going to be able to wait till the end of the day until I look at the spot again. But what I will do is, you know, we'll do a first pass. I'll do a second pass. Make some tweaks. Coffee break.
Right.
Go out, have a cup of coffee, chit chat.
Walk around
about
the block.
Whatever. Yeah. Well, you know, it'd be lovely if those clients gave me the time to walk around the block, but they seldom do. But, you know, just take a break. Get out for 10, 15 minutes. Go back in. Boom. You've got your fresh eyes already. These two shots are sticking out. Tweak them.
Right.
Then I can send them out the door with a song in my heart, knowing that it's as tight as it's going to be.
Right.
And, you know, and also knowing, it's like, look, if you're not going to air tonight or tomorrow, you know, if you spool up the file and look at it and, oh, gee, you know, here's something we missed, give me a call. I mean, revisions are not a dirty word. You know, it's not like I go out of my way to just let stuff out the door that I know needs to be revised. But, you know, the truth is, you sleep on something. This is especially true of features, you know. There are plenty of scenes where filmmakers, they could go a little more warm or they could go a little more cool, and they're not sure what they like, so they go a little more warm. Well, a week later, they wake up and they realize, no, I really wanted that a little bit more cool. It's nobody's fault.
Right.
It's just they had the time to think about it, and they had a better idea. So we go back in, we fix the scene. No big deal. I tell most of my short and feature narrative and documentary clients, you know, don't stress revisions. Plan for them. Factor them in. Yeah. You know, just assume that you're going to need another hour or two down the road to tweak some things.
Yeah.
Because it's an iterative process.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with that. It's not even particularly expensive.
And our eyes, you know, I am continually amazed at just how masterfully our eyes and our brains coordinate to make things look right for us. As we sit there and look at this stuff, it goes ahead and, you know, I'm thinking, I think I need to add a little more blue. My brain just does it. You know, it adds a little more blue and it's done. And that's, you know, one of the things that we're always fighting against. And sometimes you need to step away and let your brain reset.
Well, the thing to keep in mind is that, you know, we're all well aware of the fact that our eyes are constantly adapting to new scenes. That's, you know, half of the optical illusions out there are either functions of adaptation or they're functions of simultaneous contrast.
Right.
And so if you're sitting there and you're looking at a shot for 2 minutes, you've just adapted to it.
Yep.
And at that point, it doesn't look warm anymore, so you make it a little more warm.
Yeah.
And if you keep staring at it, you adapt to that. And it doesn't look warm anymore, so you make it look a little more warm. So you go out for your coffee break, you come back, and then you said, I've got an orange picture. Oh my God, I overdid it so much. And that's adaptation.
All right.
The thing that beginning colorists need to understand is that the audience is never going to adapt to these shots.
Right.
Because the audience is seeing a two-second shot, a three-second shot, a two-second shot, then we're out of the scene.
Right.
You know, unless you've got a scene that's, what, one five minutes long, the audience is never going to get a chance to adapt to these short scenes. So they're going to see even these small color casts that you've made. They'll see them. They'll see that style. And so you don't have to sit there and stress out about, you know, no. I need to make this blue. You know, it can't just be cool. It has to be ice cold. And, you know, if that's what you want, that's great. But the truth is, the audience has a different experience than you do in the suite. Yeah. And that's another reason not to fixate on a particular shot or a particular scene for too long, because it's going to be self-defeating.
And in fact, if you take a look at movies that are known for their extreme looks, and the most obvious comes Transformers, reason it works is because if you're going to take your reds and put them, if you're going to take your whites and just make them red, I mean, all your whites are red, right? Mm-hmm. But you're doing that consistently, so your audience adapts to that. And now what looks wrong is when you kind of vary off of that within a scene. Then
when you leave the theater, then all of a sudden everything looks just dull and lifeless. And
exactly, because he's just like just completely blown
life,
it out for you.
Life becomes not worth living after seeing a Michael Bay movie. Exactly. His world of amazing explosions and shit. No, that's absolutely true. I've been in movies where, you know, you're sitting there and the first 2 minutes, you're like, oh my God, this grade is so extreme. I had that experience with Rock'n'Rolla, Guy Ritchie's film. It has, I think, the most extreme version of a bleach bypass or skip bleach effect that I have ever seen. I mean, it's virtually, when you first look at it, it's virtually desaturated and super high contrast. It's an extreme, extreme look. I mean, you know, usually you see a photochemical skip bleach and you're like, yeah, it's skip bleach. It's higher contrast, subdued saturation. Maybe the highlights are blown out. Maybe they're not. But it's, you know, it's not off the reservation crazy. It's usually just higher contrast. But this one was, whoa. Well, sure enough, after 5 minutes, I stopped noticing it. Right. You will adapt visually to anything if it's consistent enough.
And that's what you're looking to achieve is the consistency.
Well, or not. I mean, Traffic is an example of extreme color casts that were introduced. And they continued to be extreme because from story to story,
right.
we flipped
yep.
from the green look to the yellow look,
yep.
to the desaturated look, to the whatever. And so we didn't have a chance to adapt because, you know, within any 5 minute or 10 minute segment, yeah, we got used to it. But then we cross that threshold into another scene and bang, we're hit with another.
But then again, I mean, once you cross over that threshold, then within that storyline, you want to keep it consistent. I mean,
In theory, you want to.
I mean, obviously, the rules are made to be broken. And in the end, we can do whatever we want. We just have to understand the impact it has on the audience. And as we continuously make these extreme changes, and if you have extreme inconsistencies, you've got to understand it's going to affect at some level.
Well, I mean,
the audience and their perception.
I go even farther. It's not some level. If the color and exposure is uneven from shot to shot, you're giving the editing away.
Right.
You know, in a narrative project, a skilled editor is working very hard to achieve that
point.
Invisible editing.
Yeah.
You know, they're killing themselves with split edits and cutting in the middle of dialogue lines and anything they can do with cutaways and to just, you know, line of sight cuts and all these tricks to have us just go with the flow and not notice any of these cuts are happening. But if the exposure and the color are off, you're going to see every cut. You're going to see the cuts. It defeats invisible editing. And that's why it's so critical if you're looking for invisible editing. That's why it's so critical to make sure that you're balancing the color and contrast of shots within a scene and, so that it evens out.
And this was one reason why in Traffic, where you jump from extreme look, it actually probably helps the storytelling because you're telling all these simultaneous stories. There's probably a fear editorially that we're going to get lost. And the director's like, no, don't worry about it. I've got other cues that will keep us on the rails
right.
as we jump between the story.
Right. And, you know, when you're talking about scenic changes, this is a question I get a lot, which is, well, you know, we should probably grade this scene the same way we graded the last scene because we don't want to throw the audience out of the story. And, you know, my feeling has long been, if you're going from one location to another or from one time to another, you have an opportunity to switch up the color. Now, I'm not necessarily talking Traffic level color cast
right.
introduction, and I'm not necessarily talking, you know, anything massively stylized. I'm just saying, no matter what kind of grade you're doing, when you cross the boundary of a scene, it's your opportunity to take the color and contrast into a different direction if it serves the story,
right.
if it serves what the director and the DP are trying to do. You know, I mean, that's just life, right? You walk from your apartment out the door, out into the world,
yeah.
the light changes.
Yep.
We all experience that. The audience will go with you
right.
If you want to do that to a certain point.
Right.
So I'm never afraid to switch up the grade from scene to scene. But it's something where, you know, clients who've never done a full-blown color correction, they may be a little hesitant. Yeah, and you know, again, it's whatever they want to do. If they want the entire film to balance out, that's fine. There's no, that's not a wrong answer.
Right.
I just like to remind people that we have the flexibility and the audience will go with you.
Yeah. And that seems like a good place to stop as our interview quickly veers into a long and focused discussion on setting up your grading room. That'll be part 3 of our discussion with Alexis. Full show notes for this interview with links to everything we've discussed can be found at taoofcolor.com. That's Tao with a T, or if you prefer, Tao with a D, ofcolor.com. Thanks for listening.